I think, you know, in the kind of current era, there have been a lot of new protocols that are being built on top of Ethereum. Some of them are roll-ups, as many of you know. And some of them are sort of these kind of new kind of amphibious things that are sort of known as AVSs or networks or services. So a natural question you might say is, you know, what's the difference between these? You know, when do I need to pay for a roll-up security? When do I need to pay for something that's less? And how do I quantify that? So there's sort of three things we'll talk about. We'll talk about restaking sort of being a matching market. We'll talk about how to think about threat models for determining economic security. And then finally, we'll talk about how do you quantify that. And so most of this talk, there are a bunch of papers that have sort of the formal results, but this is sort of going to give a high-level description. So a natural question is what is a matching market? So matching market, kind of the most common one people think of, is, in this example, sort of matching partners. And so each person has a preference, and based on their preferences, you can kind of construct this graph and then try to find a valid matching. And so it's sort of a natural thing where you want to match two different types of goods, one side that's the supply side and one side that's the demand side. Of course, I guess in the dating one, it, maybe they're both symmetric, hopefully. But you know, what is a matching market? So matching markets are sort of things that are studied in economics but also used in practice a lot. So probably the most famous type of matching market is the kidney exchange. So this is for people who need kidney transplants. You know, maybe I had some type of accident, I need a kidney transplant, but I can't just take any kidney. There's some constraints on it. It has to be a certain size, it has to be the right blood type, it has to have a bunch of different things. And so there are people who are donors who are willing to donate kidneys, and then people who need kidneys, and there's sort of, you'd be surprised, but there are algorithms for kind of matching them. But the main thing to think about is there's a supply of inhomogeneous goods, i.e. people whose kidneys have some properties, you know, blood type, size, etc. The key thing is there's some similarity between them. They're all kidneys, but they have some special properties. And then there's sort of demand, which is people who kind of want to receive those. So, you know, in crypto, you hear a lot about auctions. In fact, someone yesterday told me they were surprised I went an hour without saying the word auction, which I felt embarrassed about. But so you might say, you know, how do matching markets compare to auctions? So matching markets are sort of more focused on stability under to perturbations of different kind of mechanisms, versus auctions are focused on things like maximizing revenue or maximizing welfare. So for instance, a matching may prefer to sell all goods to all people participating, even if it doesn't maximize the amount of money that's transferred. And in crypto, we have a bunch, right? We have MEV auctions for the auction side, and we have intents and also restaking for matching markets. So a natural place to kind of formalize matching markets is using graph theory, using sort of bipartite graphs, where the idea is you have one side that is the set of suppliers, the different types of supply, and the other side is the types of demand. But in most classical matching markets, this graph is sort of static, i.e. the set of people who want kidneys or need kidneys is fixed, and there's usually a central planner. Now, decentralized matching markets don't have either of these features, because people can join and leave whenever they want, they can change their demand whenever they want, and this is why we need to start a little bit by thinking about restaking in terms of being a decentralized matching market. So, decentralized matching market, you can have the supply side and demand side join and leave at will, and so a natural question is, you know, why are these harder to analyze? How are they harder to analyze? First off, if people can join and leave, you can get matched and unmatched. Which means that you have to consider kind of worst case dropout from different participants. The second thing is, without having a central planner, without having kind of like the national kidney registry, you rely on how you pay incentives, fees, token incentives, et cetera, to get people to figure out the matching. And finally, you sort of need an explicit adversarial model. So you need to kind of model all the different types of attacks. So just to kind of explain how restaking looks like a matching market. Restaking is really focused on people who are running Ethereum validators who are offering to run extra services. So you can kind of think of them as the supply side, and the demand side are services like these ABSs. So, you know, a natural question that I think is a meme in a lot of ways is economic security. As you can see from this, there's many varying definitions. But we'll take a tiny detour to talk about economic security, and then after that, and sort of how to compare economic security between roll-ups and restaking, and then kind of talk about the kind of risks in restaking. So a natural question is what does it really mean to have economic security? So, you know, the classical definition in proof of stake is, oh, 1/3 of the total amount of stake is enough to corrupt the network. Well, that's true for a double spend, but suppose I want to do an Oracle manipulation attack. It might be much cheaper. So defining economic security in absolute sense, sorry about the font color there, is actually quite difficult, partially because you have things like MEV. You have to think about the attack space. Sorry. All right, well, I guess we got a little ahead of ourselves. But basically, there's sort of a bunch of different things you have to consider. So there's a lot of different attacks. There's sort of MEV. There's attacks that come from competitive pressures between networks for competing for the same fees. But generally, we try to think of the cost of an attack as sort of something bounded by a sort of linear function of the numerair, i.e. maybe stablecoin, maybe Bitcoin, and whatever your choice of numerair is, value of the stake. So in this figure, we have the amount of asset staked, we have the price of the asset, we have a notion of the expected time it takes to execute an attack. This is sort of a measure of opportunity cost, and then we have a sort of fixed constant up front that's sort of what fraction of the network you need to execute the attack. So the natural question is, what does economic security look like for restaking? So in restaking, hopefully this is not. There are two competing pressures. The first pressure is, if people see higher yields from restaking, they purchase some fraction of stakes, so they increase the amount staked by a multiplicative factor delta. On the other hand, the slash staked, so if you know you get slash for a kind of penalty in the AVS, the slash stake reduces your overall network security. So here is something that looks a little more mischievous, but let's go through the terms. So CR is the sort of cost, kind of attack cost for restaking. So first we have a risk measure. So this is sort of a measure of how much stake, what fraction of stake do you expect to be slashed? The second is we have a notion of a price impact function. So all of these people who were not staking in the network, but they see the excess yields from restaking, they actually go and buy stake, so they increase the numerator value. And this sort of abstracts us to this function G. That's sort of a price impact function. Basically, the idea here is, if we look at this, this cost says there's two competing forces. One is the risk measure, so how much gets slashed, and the other stuff is about how you increase the value of the stake. So the natural question to ask is, when is restaking safe? So restaking can be kind of thought of as safe when you have this invariant, where like the cost of attack in a restaking network is greater than the cost of attack without the restaking network. If we write out the previous equations, we get this condition which says, hey, the risk, this risk term, the amount that has to be slashed, the maximum percentage that can be slashed, is bounded in terms of this sort of price impact, like how much more people are buying new stake to participate. So there's sort of this dependence on how elastic borrowers are to the incentives, i.e. the new fees. So we'll make a tiny detour and make a comparison to rollups. So rollups have a number of sort of natural economic trade-offs within Ethereum. A lot of the execution revenue now goes to the rollup. A lot of the MEV revenue goes to the sequencer. Again, sorry about the font. I didn't expect this. The DA revenue, which is blob space, can be dwarfed by execution revenue. So a natural question is, when do rollups, if I have a set an L1 with n rollups, when does the does that network break even with the monolithic L1? So a paper that I have coming out soon kind of shows for n rollups in under a bunch of kind of generic assumptions, you actually need n squared more revenue. So you can kind of think of this as a sort of inverse Metcalfe's law. So Metcalfe's law is sort of a kind of heuristic network law that says I have n participants in a network, the total value they get is sort of omega of n squared. This sort of says that's true for the rollup users, but the L1 is sort of paying the price, and that's sort of what this result shows. Now you might say, well, how does the revenue from AVSs compensate for restaking risk? And it turns out that if you have S AVSs, you only need this kind of factor that's decaying in the number of services. So what this says is restaking actually can provide a lot of value to the L1 and sort of increase its monetary premium in a way that's very different from rollups. So the main thing in this entire line of logic is that the risk, this R factor, is sufficiently small, right? You need to not have slashing that cascades in order for the value for the restaking network to be higher than the underlying. So a natural question is, how do you model that risk? In the previous example, it sort of relied on this notion of, are the incentives high enough for people to buy more stake and deposit? And so a natural thing to do is to now think about how to model this formally. And again, this talk has none of the proofs, but you can find them on archive. I should have put a QR code, my bad. So what does this look like abstractly, mathematically? So the basic construct is what's called a restaking graph. A restaking graph, like the matching market graphs, is a bipartite graph. In this bipartite graph, one of the bipartitions is the set of node operators. That's the set V. Each of the node operators, it's a vertex label that is stake, which is how much stake each of them have. There's a set of services, S, this is the AVSs. There's a set of profit from attacking. So this is sort of, if I attack the network, what's the maximum profit I could get? There's a set of corruption thresholds. So this is, you know, in BFT protocols, one-third is sort of this one-third of BFT stake needs to be aggregated to do a double spend. Or in the longest chain, this is the one-half. That's sort of how you can think of these. And one key difference between this restaking and proof of stake is you can have the same node operator operate multiple services with the same stake. So that is represented by this middle thing. So this operator labeled V intersection, you can think of as taking its 5 Ethereum of stake and operating both services at S1 and S2. So you might say, hey, is this thing real? Like, do these graphs exist? This is the live eigenlayer restaking graph from, I think, May to August. And you can see, basically, on the left are the node operators, who are Ethereum validators who are also running these services. On the right are the different services. There's actually far more services now. I think it's about double the number. So this graph is a lot more dense than what you see here. So when we talk about risk, we need to also talk about what it means to be an attack. What does an attack against a restaking graph look like? So the idea is you, A, need to be profitable. So that means the maximum profit for attacking a set A of services has to be greater than the maximum slashing penalty for a group of validators who are colluding to attack. So this kind of says, even if I lose my stake from doing the bad action, the profit that I get is higher. So this is what it means for a profitable attack. The second thing is a feasible attack. A feasible attack says that for every service that's being attacked, the amount of stake that the cartel that's attacking, the group of validators who are attacking that service, have is greater than the threshold times this total stake of that service. So it says, for instance, if there's 2 services in our previous example, one that has alpha as one-third, one that has alpha as one-half, the attacking cartel has to have at least one-third stake in set one and one-half stake in set two. So you can write this in symbols using this way. This comes from sort of the Eigenlayer white paper Appendix B. And then it was sort of cleaned up more by Thurvisel and Roughgarden, which sort of lays out the initial version of this. So unlike proof of stake, the interesting thing here is how to think about attacks here. So here, every service is actually over-collateralized. So service one, there's a profit of 4 and stake of 6 that could be lost. So it's not worth attacking. And service two, the same thing. However, if all the validators collude, it's actually profitable to attack both services simultaneously. And so this sort of says that, unlike proof of stake, where you're isolated, proof of stake is sort of a graph with one service. When you have multiple services and you share, you can have these kind of profitable attacks from the shared stake. So what does this look like? What is sort of the bad case of this look like? So what we're going to talk about is something known as a cascading attack. So a cascading attack is some validator somehow drops out. Maybe they're DDoSed. Maybe they lost their stake. Maybe they committed an infraction that got themselves slashed, and they get knocked out. Now, by them being knocked out, they open up an attack against the service that they were validating. So in this case, you can see the middle node operator attacks the service. And then once the middle operator attacks the service, they open up an attack on the other service. And now you can see that the entire stake has been burnt. So this is the worst case. This is R equals 1 in the previous example. And you can think of this as the proof of stake analog of like a lending liquidation cascade or a perpetual liquidation cascade. So how do we define these? So we take sets of services and operators where each of them is a feasible attack after the previous attacks are executed. And we define this quantity R psi, which is the maximum percentage of stake that can be lost due to initial loss of psi. That's how you write it formally, but don't worry about that. So you might say, hey, this tells us how much money we have to spend to secure an AVS. If we're willing to, if we choose a psi such that R psi is less than some threshold. So maybe I want that to be less than 5%, maybe I want that to be less than 10%. So this gives you a concrete way of computing how much security you need. Unfortunately, there's a bad news, which is this result, which says there's an infinite family of restaking graphs, which you burn the whole stake that have the cascades like what we saw. In the effort sense of time, I won't talk about it, but this is sort of what they look like, where the dots are validators and the boxes are services. But there's a slightly less bad news, which is a theorem from this paper that says R psi is actually bounded if the system is really over-collateralized, and we won't talk exactly about what that definition is, but this is sort of, you can interpret this as the proof-of-stake analogy of a decentralized stablecoin needs to be sufficiently over-collateralized to avoid cascading DPEGs. The problem is this over-collateralization condition is so strong that each service needs stake potentially proportional to the sum of all the profits. So as an example, imagine I have the network with two services where one of the profits is one ETH, and one is 1 million ETH. Well, the one ETH service needs to attract 1 million and one ETH to be secure to cascading attacks under this over-collateralization definition. That's not good, right? Like, if I'm a service whose max profit is one ETH, there's no way I can attract that much. I'm not going to generate that much in revenue. So you might say, OK, is this like bad? Does this mean AVSs are kind of hard? Are we never going to be able to control this risk so that we can get this kind of safe cost of attack that we started talking about? And the key here is to consider the incentives. So what we do is we now consider incentives that are paid, so think of this as like block rewards that are paid by each service to the validators, and then we also allow the validators to adjust their stake in response to the rewards, so they can change which services they're validating. And what you can show is this sort of lets you halt some of these cascading attacks. And the key things to know about this are we kind of include some notion of a cost of attack. If an adversary is attacking a bunch of services simultaneously, it costs them more than if they were just attacking one. And so having this cost actually is more realistic than the rough guard model. The second thing is we assume the node operators are smart. They are looking at the rewards and they're selfish and they're like, how do I optimize my payout? And if you get this, you know, our result is basically you can bound this risk, this R psi, in a way that decays in the number of services. And so there's also a way to approximate this. So the interpretation is if adversaries who are attacking face costs, if node operators are smarter, and if AVSs and services can pay sufficiently high rewards, the risk is small. So that actually means you can actually have these things be safely added to your network, and they generate revenue. So how do you reduce this in practice? So Eigenlayer proposed a new mechanism recently, which is called unique stake. Again, sorry about my font. where each service is allowed to say some fraction of any stake that is delegated to my service, only I can slash. Someone else can't slash it, which sort of caps the overlap, like how much a single validator can share their stake across multiple services. And if you use this, you can sort of get very nice verifiable proofs that the risk is small. And you can think of these as sort of verifiable capital requirements. And with that, I'm ready for questions, I think.
Wow. Thanks for the very informative session, Tarun. If I could invite you to stand in the middle to answer the questions. So we have one question so far. Please feel free to continue submitting more. But the first question, what's the TLDR? What's the main takeaway that you want people to know?
Main takeaway is restaking networks, generally, if you can bound the risk that they create, like from this stuff we were analyzing, they're actually very good revenue generators for L1s. They generate sort of premium for the L1 token. It's a little bit, it actually is somewhat counterintuitive, but the result is that they actually generate more value with a smaller number of services that generate fees than rollups. You actually need way more rollups to generate, you need way more fees from rollups to compensate the L1, whereas in restaking, it's actually a lot lower. And so the point is this is only true if this risk is bounded, that it's sufficiently small. And so, you know, most of this result is like, how do you show that risk is small? Under what conditions is that risk small? And that's kind of what we're showing, which is basically that validators are need to be active management, and the adversaries face costs.
All right, so we see a couple more questions coming in. Let's go to the first one. So should we advocate or enshrine restaking protocols then?
Yeah, so this is a great question. I'm not sure about the political liberty on this, but I actually think restaking protocols, because they generate so much revenue potentially for the L1, it actually does make sense in a lot of ways for them to be enshrined. Of course, you know, you also have to keep in mind all of these extra risks you have. And so I think it would take a lot longer for the L1 to really be able to justify it. But yeah.
Okay, so we see a couple more that's coming up. I'll read the one. So what do you think about asset migration from one restaking protocol to another?
Yeah, great question. So I think like in a world where there's no restrictions, no unbonding time, where you can immediately move your stake, you have a lot of problems where you can open up attacks. But generally, if you look at Symbiotic, Eigenlayer, Jito, all of the major restaking networks are actually giving have sort of unbonding times and sort of friction for you moving between them. And that friction is actually quite important for their security in a lot of ways. And I think this is one of the reasons it might not make sense to enshrine right now. It's probably better to see how these different restaking networks work in practice, how much revenue they generate, and then over time figure out how to internalize them. But I think restaking is a little bit different than MEV in the sense that it's not really parasitic to users unless you have these cascading slashing events. And so as long as you limit those, it's just more money for the L1 stakers.
Okay. Yeah, great answer. So wait, there's a couple more, and we still have time as well. So let's talk about, can you go over the 1ETH and 1M example again?
For sure. So yeah, imagine I have two services. Let's take two AVSs. Let's say one is EigenDA, and let's say the other one is an Oracle. And let's suppose that, you know, EigenDA doesn't have that much in fees right now, and the max profit you get from getting the validators to collude to attack it is 1 ETH. On the other hand, suppose the Oracle is tied to a perpetuals exchange. So if I could manipulate the Oracle, I can cause a price to move a lot, and then I can earn a lot of profit. And imagine you could earn 1 million ETH from that. Now, if these were two separate proof of stake networks, like the DA network was its own POS network, and the Oracle network was its own POS network, then the cost of attack or the amount of stake you need should somehow be proportional to the profit. So for the Oracle, I would need 1 million ETH. For the DA layer, I would only need 1 ETH. But if they're used in restaking and they have a lot of overlapping validators, the 1 ETH service, the one that has 1 ETH of attack profit, has to pay It has to attract an amount of stake that's equal to 1 million and 1 ETH, so the sum of their profits, if they have a lot of shared validators. And this is because if the shared validators get slashed, it kills both of them at the same time. It doesn't just kill one of them. And so this is sort of one of the reasons, in the worst case, you have this additive behavior.
Okay. I think we have a short while more. I'd like to thank Tarun for the questions. Please give him a round of applause.